Blog Talk Radio.
November the 23rd, 2010, and you're listening to the Weekly Economics and Financial Roundup Show with the Optimistic Bear. This is the show where armchair economists rule the roost. We don't claim to be experts on finance or the economy, but we sure love talking about it. Anything that we can tangentially claim to be related to finance and economics is fair game for discussion on this show. And as always, we love to hear from our listeners, so please do call in at area code 917-388-4810. Tell us what you're seeing in the economy these days. What do you think is up ahead around the corner, as they say, with the economy in the coming year? And thanks. I think we have Elliot on the line.
Yes, you do. How's it going, Michael?
Really good. Thanks for calling in again.
Are you surviving the winter?
Oh, yes. For our listeners who aren't aware, the Optimistic Bear, or otherwise known as Michael, lives in Seattle, and so does Elliot, or in the Seattle area. And every time that we get a little bit of snow, the entire region comes to a grinding halt. And so today was a snow day, and I stayed at home, did work via telecommuting. So I'm surviving.
Great. Is it just the two of us tonight?
So far, just us two. And you, did you manage to make it into the office today?
Yes, I made it in, but only by trekking it. There was no way I was going to risk taking the car out. It looks like it's doable, but there's always this small chance that you'll get stuck somewhere, and then that's a disaster, you know, in terms of getting a tow truck and so forth. So it's not worth the risk if you can make the walk.
No, I well understand.
It's funny, though, because this is not stop snow. I mean, I lived in Boston for 4 years, and, you know, you would get, you know, 4 feet of snow or whatever. But it all has to do with the amount you get versus, you know, if it's just at that right amount where it's enough to be to shut things down, but it's not frequent enough to have good city defense against it, then it shuts the city down, and we're right on that edge here, I guess. But Boston, you know, it was so frequent and so much of it that they were really prepared in terms of salting and spraying and so forth.
Yeah, well, here we only get a dusting 3 or 4 times a year, and so it's hard, I guess, for the cities to justify having tons of snow plows and lots of material devoted towards fighting snow. So whenever it does snow, they just kind of let the whole region shut down.
Right.
Which I guess, could there be parallels to the economy and economics on that?
Right. It never snows, so why be prepared? It's so rare that it snows. But when it does snow, it'll shut everything down.
Yeah, well, I mean, it also goes to, you know, how much should you invest in being prepared for those blizzards when they happen, right? Should a person go get snow tires? So in our region, having snow tires is certainly very helpful if you have to be driving around in the snow. But in our region, since practically maybe there's a good 5 days of real snow that you have to deal with in a normal year, is it
right.
worthwhile spending $800 or so to get a whole set of snow tires whose treads only last for like 3 months? And are you going to take that? Are you going to take them off as soon as this? You start wondering where the economic sense lies.
Right. Well, sort of like if you buy stocks and you hedge your position with put options on them, and you're spending all that premium on them all the time. You know, is it really worth it? But then those few times when the market tanks, you know, it's nice to have them.
I suppose it depends what the downside is. There's the lesson. If the only real consequence is to being caught unprepared, so being caught without – if the only consequence of being caught without snow tires in the Seattle area is that for a few days a year you just have to stay at home, then that's not so bad. But if the consequence is that once a year – you might die because of some critical problem with the weather, then it might be worth investing in all kinds of preparations to deal with adverse weather, even if that adverse weather only occurred once or twice every 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's a good parallel for the stock market. It's historically things are usually on an uptrend, but every now and then they can take a pretty darn huge spill, and so you know it pays to have some sort of protection against those occurrences. I think because they can be very very devastating in the long run.
Sure. Well, and in the case of snow, I mean, it hasn't bothered me not having snow tires right now, but heaven forbid that there was a medical emergency in my family, it might be very difficult to get to a hospital or an emergency room on a snow day.
Yep. So what's been going on in the markets lately? Aside from the weather, it seems like it's been relatively quiet. We've come down a bit here, but we haven't had any, you know, huge days by any means.
Well, today was certainly not an optimistic day. Just the only two more days left, right, till the holiday, one more day after today, but. The Dow was down 142 points, or 1.3%. The Nasdaq down 1.46%. We still closed above 11,000 in the Dow, but at one point intraday it was below 11,000. So we're still up. I mean, certainly way above 10,000. I mean, it's still even above 11,000, but. According to the news, there's been a lot of jitters about Europe and the euro and sovereign debt problems, and with Ireland being in focus and the government of Ireland now in chaos as various parties in the coalition government are withdrawing support, and it looks like an election might be in the offing, and even some of the members of Fianna Fáil, I don't know the right way to pronounce their ruling party's name, which, by the way, if I'm correct, it stands for Warriors of Destiny. Now, what a name for a political party! Why don't we have names like that in America, huh?
What is it, Warriors in Destiny?
Warriors of Destiny. I mean,
Destiny.
Think of that
wow.
for a name for a political party. That's a good one, you know.
My question
Nothing
is,
like
you know, okay, it's a great name, but what's the destiny that they're warring over? That's what I care about. Give me some bullet points.
Well, we'll get to that in a second, but because of the political instability there, people were, you know, the news anyway had it that the markets were spooked about whether the European sovereign debt problems are going to be solved and whether they can truly bail out the nations that, that have problems, or whether the nations that have debt problems would even accept the bailouts. Because a lot of Irish people are upset about their government's negotiations with the EU for some kind of bailout right now.
Right.
And so, I mean, there has been news, in other words, even though we haven't seen the bottom fall out of markets. And not that news drives markets. If anything, it's likely the other way around. But it's still interesting to see what people gravitate towards. And that there are concerns about, I think rightly so, there are concerns about some of the debt problems that, that are going on in Europe. And, and back to political parties, I mean, what do they stand for? I was listening to a news item today where they were interviewing a bunch of regular Irish people in a pub. How more Irish can you get than that? And of Irish citizens. And they were complaining about how they hate their prime minister. And the reason why is because his great sin was that he played with their optimism, and that he had been instrumental and misled them to feel that they were rich and that there was a great future for their country, and that now that there isn't, now they are mad. And in the, and one gentleman was even saying, oh, well, in the past when we had recessions, it was no big deal because our economy was so bad you didn't really notice much when they were, when you had a recession. But now that we have something, now that we're losing it, we're mad. And I just thought that that was very fascinating listening to that perspective. And I don't know.
Well, they were really booming prior to this recession. They were, or I don't know if they're technically still in it or not. That's a, another debate. But I mean, I heard something about their software industry just absorbing people, and a lot of people even from the U.S. going there to start companies and stuff. So they were definitely a shining beacon of light, I think, in Europe for a while. But, of course, everyone's you know, hurt now just because of all the massive overinvestment, really, overzealousness. So one other thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah?
Well, I just think Ireland clearly followed a bubble pattern, just like most others.
Right.
And bubbles, I think, no matter where they happen, whatever country, whatever culture, it's always the same phenomena. A bubble occurs because the masses, it can't just be a handful of people, it's because the majority of the people in that country, or a large number of them, start to feel that they're in a new era, that everything is going, there can be no wrong, that everyone is going to get rich. And when everyone starts to behave that way, then that's pretty much what makes it inevitable that the rails are going to come off the whole system.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get rich without working. That's the sad truth that, well, I don't know if it's sad, but that's the truth that most people don't want to face. And investment manias are one of those sort of rare times in history where you can get rich without working if you're lucky. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of people usually end up losing a lot in the end. Or I should say the vast majority must, out of necessity, because that's the way any kind of bubble works. But in any event, I was actually going to talk technicals really briefly, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Don't take too much time with tea leaves, as you call them, on past shows. But one of those things, one of my favorite indicators that I always watch is the slow stochastic oscillator. If you want to look at it, you can just go to stockcharts.com and take a look at pretty much any chart and put it on there. And the values I like are 8, 8, and 5, because I like using Fibonacci numbers, and I've tried a lot of other values, and they just don't seem to work as well for me. But you know, everyone has their favorite ways of setting these up. But I find, even though it's not always perfectly accurate in terms of helping you pick tops and bottoms, one of the things that it's incredibly helpful for is just helping you think cyclically. You know, because a lot of times the market will have it'll be going up and it'll have a pullback, and people will be pointing to this and that, or this news event or that news event. And sometimes it's nice when you're watching the oscillators, you just kind of relax and you have a feel for, okay, we're a little overbought now on the short term and we'll have a little pullback. And the market usually, you know, it always behaves that way. It never moves in a straight line. And so just it keeps you sort of thinking that way, thinking cyclically and expecting these things to happen. That's probably my favorite thing about it. But in any event, what I was watching it and on the stock market and on many other markets, the momentum, if you take a look at it, is extremely overbought and rolling over to the downside on a weekly chart. If you take a look at that indicator, you can look at SPX, the Dow, you can look at gold, silver, pretty much anything. They all have that exact same setup. And then also, if you look at the inverse, you can see the dollar as the inverse of that, and treasury bonds are also in an inverse, meaning that they're oversold and momentum is now turned the other way. And that's on the weekly chart. Now, on the daily chart, if you look at the same indicator, you'll see it actually got quite a bit oversold on stocks. So I was expecting a bounce, and we got some this week. And I thought, after yesterday's behavior, I thought today, like, I was really surprised we went down today. I thought, well, we got to correct a bit more and move higher. Today's move down was kind of a surprise. So we'll see. We're still oversold on the short term, but we'll see how that sort of works its way through over Thanksgiving. But, you know, the weekly charts, in terms of momentum, are all lining up that says we might see more deflation ahead here, especially with the dollar moving up really strongly again. So maybe after Thanksgiving, we'll start seeing more of that. But, yeah, that's my quick
opinion. Or maybe in the new year.
Based on those oscillators. Yeah, for the new year, exactly.
Well, it's just the holiday time, or November and December in the United States, is typically very – it lacks any drama in normally, for understandable reasons, hey. Because a lot of traders and investors and so on are focused on other things, and they're not as zeroed in on what's happening in stocks and the economy and so on. So, hey, there's no guarantees on anything, but if there was going to be any major action occurring and dramatic swings, it might happen after in January or later or sometime in the new year.
Right, you're absolutely right. Seasonally, this is kind of a bullish time of year, especially around the new year. What's the saying? Sell in May and go away or something? It's basically, you know, through that holiday period, you know, it's not when you want to be selling if you're long, based on a purely seasonals model. But you know, seasonals are just tendencies, and you have to money manage around them. And certainly we pointed out many months ago that September, October are seasonally the most bearish months of the year. And this year we had the best September since like 1938, I think. So it was not only a good September, it was a historically good September, you know, nearly 100 years. So, or, you know, 70 years.
True. Yeah, absolutely. And as our listeners well know, we've talked many times about how if there is one principle that applies in the market, it's your principle, Elliot, of maximum ruin, which basically means that the markets will do what the majority of the people least expect. Therefore, if everyone is relying far too heavily on the seasonals, then it isn't going to work, the seasonal tendencies. And as you even pointed out, the seasonal tendency for September and October of being bearish months did not pan out. So I suppose then who's to say that the historically bullish months would necessarily have to be bullish?
Well, you know, these seasonal things are interesting. I actually was talking to a guy who had a friend who was a commodity trader at a bank who relied upon this statistical system that did seasonal type of studies. It was just a huge database that they could mine to find seasonal tendencies. And they found these tendencies in certain commodities, and they built this system to trade them based on those tendencies. So the trader was basically running it, and they were, you know, had some money they were managing, and he made money for a while and then lost it, and the model was basically wrong for 3 years in a row. And by the end of the third year, after having another year of losses, everybody basically pulled the money out and they're like, that's it, all right, you know, come up with something else. And then, of course, you can guess what happened. The next 3 years after that, the system was, like, incredibly profitable. If they had stuck with it, they would have made a fortune. So, you know, the market is just, it's just funny like that. That's, you know, these things are all tendencies, and really what it comes down to, no matter what you're trying to do, money management is by far the number one most important thing. You know, the market's going to fool you, and you've got to be prepared for anything and how you're going to manage that. You know, if you have here's a great example. If someone, let's say someone is buying hold, like so many advisors say these days and have been for a long time. Personally, I don't really believe in buy and hold at all, as you well know. But here's the problem with it. If you're 100% long stocks, buy and hold, what is the strategy? You know, if stocks go up, that's great. All right, you hold them. Do you take some off the table? Well, if it's buy and hold, you don't. But what if they go down 50% like they did in 2008? At what point do you say, all right, I just can't take any more losses? Because the thing is, if you don't have a method, if you haven't thought it out what you're going to do in every situation that may arise in the future, then you really don't have any approach at all. You're just going to eventually cave into your emotions and sell, which unfortunately is usually at the worst possible time. But, you know, I don't know. That's what's sad is that so many professionals are giving people advice to do things that are emotionally impossible to do, such as holding stocks through a large downturn. You know, people just can't do it. You, at some point, you lose faith, and then you're going to sell right before a big rally starts. In any event, that's my spiel on why having a strategy is so important.
Well, some people would say that they do not have the emotional capacity to simply sit on, or the emotional wherewithal to stay in cash, and that just the very thought that they are losing investment opportunities will keep them awake at night. And so I suppose it all depends on what your particular emotional bent is, and how you live with things.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely true. You have to understand your own emotions when you're investing and what you can and cannot handle. But a big part of the problem is it's hard to understand that until you've actually been there. You know, I'm sure there were plenty of buy and holders who thought they could hold, but 2008 they just couldn't hold, you know, and things like that. for me, I mean, I've thought about this, and personally, I'm pretty conservative, and there's a strategy I think I've thrown out there on the show before, but it's worth looking at because I keep throwing it out to more people. It's a very, very conservative way to invest is to focus entirely on real values that are tied to production as opposed to speculation to the extent that it's possible to do so. And what I mean is instead of thinking of I'm going to buy a stock to get a capital gain, you focus on I'm going to buy it to get a dividend. And sort of same thing with bonds. And I think this is a pretty good approach because if you look back through history, usually when stock dividends are much higher than bonds, it usually is, you know, you're closer to a bottom than to a top. Now, it's obviously far from perfect. But, you know, focusing on that immediate return that you can get is definitely safer, I think, than trying to focus on betting on what may or may not happen in the future. So the simplest way and one of the most risk-free ways to invest is, first of all, a good money market fund. And I've shopped around a lot for money market funds, and the best one I've found, hands down, is Vanguard's Prime. Very, very high quality securities. I think right now they hold mostly treasuries and incredibly low expense ratio, and it goes down if you put a lot of money in it. Most other competitors have, like, their expense ratios are like three times as high, which is ridiculous. So you have to hold lower quality debt to get the same yield, which is not a good idea in my opinion. But in any event, there's that, and then you can buy short-term, very high-quality bonds, corporate bonds, since they're tied to production. That's a good one to earn that yield. But again, or at least for me, I would only buy the ones that are super high-quality. And, you know, if you had done this and built yourself a bond ladder just 2 years out or 2.5 years out, this strategy is actually, over the past decade, dramatically outperformed stocks. It's up like 55%. And with almost no drawdowns or and far less risk. So, you know, grandma-style investing, in my opinion, should come first, you know, and then if you want to take a small chunk of your grandma strategy and put it into something a little more dangerous or speculative, you know, you can do that, but make sure you've got a plan for it.
Maybe you can help explain something, Elliot.
Yeah.
There have been complaints from investors about the very low coupons that they receive that have been issued with some of the large debt issuances or corporate debt issuances recently. So Microsoft
right.
and Walmart, for example, had they issued bonds this year that had very low borrowing costs for the company.
Yeah, they're like lower than T-notes, right, or something?
Right, and now what's happened since then is investors have lost even more money on them because they've decreased in value in the aftermarket. And
the rates have gone
exactly,
up.
The rates have gone up. So how is that bad to investors to have rates go up?
Well,
because that means that you can now get a higher interest rate, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you bought, you know, here's the classic example of why you have to be careful when you buy bonds other than default risk. And we already done that on another show. You never want to buy junk bonds. But if you bought a 10-year bond or, okay, let's go nuts. Let's say you bought a 30-year bond in 1965. You buy a 30-year bond. That would be pretty horrible timing because moving on into the 70s, you know, we saw inflation just go nuts. And there was almost no inflation after the Great Depression until the 70s. It was all just nil, basically. So interest rates were very low. So, yeah, if you bought a bond then and interest rates go sky high, then who in the heck is going to buy your bond that's paying a few percentage points when you can get one that pays 18%? You know, right off the market. So, of course, the price for your bond, if you were to sell it, would go down. And so here's the thing is that you could say, well, if I hold it 30 years, I get the face value of it. But, of course, you have to add all the inflation over time that has occurred. And then in those 30 years, you know, you may have lost real value by buying that bond. So bonds are not risk-free at all. But that's why I say you stick to shorter terms. If you buy a 3-year bond on a ladder, that especially on a ladder, then every 3 years you're just rolling over the top end of your bond ladder. So you're basically following interest rates, kind of like a moving average over time. You're going to be a little behind the times, right? But you always catch up, and you're earning more than you would if you stayed in a money market. So, I mean, it's basically
if
you can get, and then I'm saying go a little bit more dangerous. This is still grandma investing. It's pretty safe.
So if you take something like a Microsoft bond that was issued in September, they've dropped something like 2 cents on the dollar now in market trading. Now, I don't understand what's so terrible about that. If you bought the bond, a 3%, they were guaranteed a 3% yield for over 10 years, or it's a 10-year issue, then you're still,
okay.
That hasn't changed, right? The fact that the market, if you wanted to go sell it today, that it's worth 2 cents less on the dollar than what you'd paid for it, I don't see what's so terrible about that. I mean, certainly, if you went and bought a junk bond, you get a higher rate, but your risk is atrocious.
Well, and here's the thing: if you bought the bond and the price goes down, you're right. It doesn't affect you if A, you hold the thing until it matures, and B, they don't default in that time. You know, so you're might be losing out on other opportunities. And I would say, C, that inflation doesn't go sky high, you know, in the meantime, and then suddenly you're stuck with this 3% yield and everything else pays 10. You know, but, you know, that's why the shorter-term maturities you buy, the less risk you have, because of all those three risks are basically mitigated by that fact. So if suddenly the bond you hold, if the issuing company is in trouble, well, hey, maybe it only has 6 months left before the bond matures, so you can just let it mature and then look somewhere else to put that money. But, you know, if you buy a really long-term bond with a company and it starts to get into trouble, financial trouble, and your bond price falls, you know, then you really are in trouble. You know, it's too late to do much about it.
So
that's the thing, you know, the farther out on the yield curve you go, the more you could earn in theory, but your risk goes up a lot. So, you know, I mean, this whole trend of falling bond yield and rising prices since 1980 is something that doesn't last forever. We've talked about the Kondratiev cycle before and interest rates, and, you know, we're going to have a bottom here sometime. It might take a decade, but eventually it's going to bottom and interest rates will start going up again, just like they've done 4 or 5 times in the history of the United States in this, you know, very long-term interest rate cycle. We'll start going right back up, and then bonds are going to be a risky investment again.
So, switching subjects a bit again, and actually we're going back a little bit to Ireland. I couldn't help but notice this week, well, there was an interesting article that came out about how there's been a run on the Allied on a bank in Ireland called Allied Irish Banks, and customers have pulled something like 17% of all deposits from the bank since June, and this is pretty significant, and it's putting the bank at risk. And this is part of all the reasons that we keep hearing Ireland in the news and the bailouts being negotiated and so on. And what is particularly interesting about this is that it was only earlier this year that Europe ran stress, quote unquote, stress tests on all of the major banks throughout the Eurozone.
Right.
I can't remember if non-Euro nations were involved, but certainly Eurozone nations were. And every Irish bank passed. In fact, there was no bank in Europe that didn't pass the stress test under their worst case scenario that they'd had the banks investigate. And yet already we see there are banks and AIB, Allied Irish Banks, being very prominent in that group, are performing worse than the worst scenario under the stress tests. And what this just goes to show me, to show everybody, and any of our listeners who are tuning into this, they should remember, think of this, remember it. When policymakers and politicians tell you something, don't believe it. They have a vested interest in trying to calm everybody down, and they will not tell. I don't know whether lying is correct per se, but they have no interest in trying to really explore how bad things are, and in really letting in telling that to the general public. And so when you hear politicians stand up, or policymakers, ministers of the Treasury or whatever, chancellors of the exchequer and so on, telling you, or central bankers saying, feel confident, there are no problems, you can't believe one word they say. Because if there were, they wouldn't be telling you that. And clearly, all of these stress tests and other machinations that are done to try to build confidence, to try to investigate and find where there are problems in the financial system, there are no such thing. They are public relations exercises. And I just thought that this example of the run on Allied Irish Bank, the bank that had passed regulator scrutiny and these so-called stress tests, that this is a perfect example of this phenomena of the emperor having no clothes, and why you can't believe anything that these people say. I just had to get that off my chest.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, imagine a bunch of people in they're holding up something. Let's say you're sitting in a chair and everyone's holding the chair up in the air. You're sitting in a chair and you look down at a spider on someone's shoulder. Do you tell them or not? Because if you tell them, they're going to panic and the whole thing is going to fall down, you know, and you might get hurt. But if you keep your mouth shut, there's a chance that spider will kind of go away and then it won't collapse. To some extent, you know, I think that there's, let's just keep painting a rosy picture of these banks, because if depositors don't pull their money out, then the bank might make it. That's what's funny about a lot of these things, and it's true with debt issues too, that it's not just the institution, it's the investor's perception of it and their actions that feed back into that. You know, during 2008, actually, I remember there were some institutions that, if you looked at their balance sheet, were actually very sound and were probably not in trouble. And yet, if you looked at their bonds, there was panic. You know, there was just general panic in the credit markets, and it was really baby out with the bathwater. And a lot of these very sound institutions, you know, had their investments were also declining in value. So it's interesting, because with these banks, you know, they might not be in trouble unless people panic, and then they are in trouble for real, and there's a reason to panic. So it's kind of recursive, I suppose.
Yeah, well, and I can understand why policymakers would want to be soothing and calming, and why they wouldn't want to panic anyone with the unpleasant truth of things. I get that. I understand it. But then as investors or as consumers of information, anyone who believes what they say should have their heads examined. Or it's just naive to believe that what they're saying really is the truth.
Right, that's true.
And I will go further.
If you want to get your news, you gotta find your own sources. And I think the course of the past few years have definitely shown you can't listen to figureheads. In fact, there was that viral video that was talking about Bernanke and his predictions and going through them one by one, and you'll see that, you know, they're basically wrong about everything they call. I mean, he was talking about subprime being contained, and that was like a few days before Lehman went bust and the whole thing sort of started coming apart with the investment banks. So, you know, I don't know. I think the Fed just basically says the same thing no matter what's going on, which is that things will moderate. And I guess sometimes that works, but sometimes they're really off.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I understand why you would want to panic people. But you do lose credibility as well if everything – and, hey, just as you were talking about Bernanke, people now go – he's losing credibility because increasingly the things that he said don't turn out to be true. So then
Right. Why
would people then have – so the next time you then go and tell people, don't worry, don't panic, that's the last thing they're going to do because the previous times you said that, it turned out not to work out so well. And
go ahead.
No, go on.
Well, I was going to say, what can a central bank do, though, other than say everything's okay, because that's kind of supposed to be their job, is to, you know, encourage economic stability. Now, so anytime they say, hey, you know, we've got a bubble here or something bad could go wrong here, watch out for this, you know, to an extent that's admitting something. Because you can't say watch out for X, Y, or Z because you're the central bank. You're supposed to save everybody no matter what happens and make everything great, right? I think there's just so many reasons why they can't possibly ever really point anything out negative, at least about themselves or things they're supposed to have a direct impact on. I don't know. I mean, the only negative things I guess I've seen come out of the Fed recently are Bernanke talking about Congress spending too much money and the deficit is getting too high. But that's him chastising Congress, right? He's not talking about anything that, you know, they have are supposed to have control over, I should say.
Yeah, well... I'm glad I don't have the job.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You can't win. It's a hard job. But
well,
in other
some
news,
jobs. Go on.
Yeah. No, go
in
finish
other news.
This stuff because I was going to bring up something else.
I don't mind, but I just say some jobs you can't win by definition. By whatever the job is, but that's enough of that topic.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think in terms of the markets turning, for the most part, for, you know, these past couple weeks, for the most part, it's been very mild. You know, stocks have pulled back a little bit, but it's pretty mild, and same thing in other markets. But there's one market I'm watching which has not been mild at all, which the turn around the same time with the others was very dramatic, is municipal bonds. If you look at a chart of those, it's pretty much a mini crash. I mean, they've taken out an entire year's worth of gains in just the past 2 weeks. It's a very dramatic chart if you take a look at it. And again, those same momentum indicators I'm talking about are showing that it probably is going to keep going lower. And I think, you know, we talked about this a bit last week, but this is obviously very much related to the fact that the states just have gotten themselves in way over their heads with these, you know, pension obligations and all kinds of services and just really random things like, you know, the park beautification department, you know, and I don't know. I mean, there's just so many departments that they've expanded into since the housing bubble started, and they just got flush with immense cash from property taxes. And now there's this need, I think, to unwind a lot of that and restructure pensions. But, I mean, if those interest rates keep skyrocketing, it's going to – I don't know. I mean, again, like I said last week, it just makes me so – upset that they're this irresponsible to let it get to the point where this is happening, because, you know, they should have learned their lesson in 2008 and really started cutting these things and so they could meet their obligations, but they didn't, and the markets got reliquified, investors poured money back into them, they seem to be surviving, but they didn't really do what they needed to do, and now the markets are turning against them again. And so now they're just in, you know, horrible shape. It's just like, take your medicine early and you'll get better. But if you don't take the medicine and just keep putting it off and off and off, finally, you know, you're going to get really sick. And so I think that's where we are now with this huge turn we've seen in muni bonds over the past couple weeks.
Well, to play devil's advocate here, I did read one article that was suggesting that the problems in the muni market might be more related to just a glut of supply that's come on the market in recent months, more than it is to concerns about the finances of municipalities. And recently, apparently, there's been quite a surge in debt issuances by many local governments, and there's a bunch of large issues that are anticipated coming up very soon as well, and simply that huge volume of new debt issuances is simply larger than the demand for munis, and so it's not that investors are spooked or anything, but that just simply there's such a big volume of these issuances happening right now that leads to weakening in price.
Well, whatever the exact cause of it, the point is that these states, which are already strapped for cash, their interest rates are going up that they have to pay. So that may be it. Maybe they're flooding the markets, but the result is the same. And so with higher interest rates, it's going to make it that much harder to meet those obligations. And again, it's that potential for a real, you know, deflationary spiral scenario where, you know, they just can't, the higher rates make it harder to pay things off, which leads to more defaults and then and higher rates as a result of, you know, the building distrust, and it just sort of continues. So, I'm pretty concerned about this huge spike in rates we've seen. But
putting it in perspective, the huge spike in rates, we're still, if I'm not mistaken, the rates are still historically low.
True. That's absolutely true.
So, I don't know. I mean, it's like a lot of concern, maybe about much ado about nothing, or relatively little at this point.
Right. You're right. We'll have to see where rates go from here. I mean, that's the key. You know, they moved a lot for 2 weeks, so you could say what their second derivative is gotten high, but certainly their absolute position is not. But we'll just see as time goes on. where if interest rates do continue higher from here, I think that's what the technicals are saying in terms of all these really long-term momentum indicators turning down.
Yeah, and I actually completely agree with you, Elliot, and I think that anyone interested in the muni market should be really looking with concern at what's been happening there recently. But I just felt it was worthwhile pointing out some of these opposing viewpoints or alternative explanations for some of the things that have been happening.
Oh, I get it. I do the same to you. That's what keeps the show interesting when you have two people on it that are a little too identical on all their views.
And I'll go so far as to say I think any investor has to be willing and able to question things themselves, even things that they believe. You should be able to understand the opposing ideas because, you know, believe it or not, you might not always be right. God knows I'm not.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, it's interesting because I was having this long talk with someone recently about systems investing versus scenario investing, and I thought it was very interesting. And so basically the distinction here is systems investing means you sat down and come up with the exact plan basically for how you're going to invest no matter what the future brings. Sort of like the way you'd play a game of chess in real time. And then scenario investing is more like you foresee a future outcome and then you invest according to that future outcome. And obviously there's some overlap. I mean, you know, you can't exactly do any kind of system without having some future expectation. But, you know, a good example of a scenario based would be like Peter Schiff, who was calling for hyperinflation a while back and basically just said, you know, put everything in emerging market stocks that are, you know, because they're not denominated in dollars, so you've got sort of double risk because you have the currency risk there. And, of course, gold mining stocks and so forth. And it was very scenario-based, and the problem with that is that he didn't really have a methodology or a system, right, for determining when he was wrong or if he was wrong or when to get out. I mean, the simplest possible system I can imagine, if you buy stocks, is to have, like, a moving average, right? The simplest thing you could do and say, look, if it goes below this moving average, I'm just going to sell it because I don't want to lose too much, you know, more than 20%. And maybe I won't make as much money in the long run if we have a bull market, but you know what? It's going to keep me from a complete disaster. And it's just simple. And for me, that would be an example of a very basic systems approach. But, you know, with the scenario approach, there's just, if the scenario does not play out, it's very hard to know what to do and when to get out, and it's just, it's really a disaster, I think, for a lot of people that get caught up into that. I mean, obviously, if you pick the right scenario, it can be, you know, immensely profitable, right? It's the best way to invest if you actually do know what's going to happen, but, you know, for the most part, most people are obviously wrong, though, when it comes to predicting the future, so it can be difficult.
Well, I do have the solution to perfect prediction.
What?
A time machine, of course.
Ah. Right.
But
there where Biff goes back in time with the almanac and bets on all the winning teams.
Of course, the problem is that even if you somehow could see what the future held and then go back, whatever you did likely would change the future such that what you previously know was no longer valid.
Are you kidding me? What would happen is we would just have it'd be the same as today. You know, today you read your thing and it's all this analysis of what might happen in the markets. Now imagine a future where you could do that, but at the same time anyone could time travel to the past and change things. But anyone could do it, right? Or anyone could go to the future and examine what the outcome was going to be. And then your analysis would have to take all that into account. So, you know, maybe it would still, in a way, almost be the same insane game of trying to predict things. In any event, I think my head is kind of spinning around now about it.
I can see it now. A new book that we should write, Elliot, The Time Traveler's Guide to Investing.
Right, right. You know.
I buy that.
The problem is, even if you go way back in time, if you bought the stock market in many countries, the stocks you buy would probably go to zero. You know, you'd have to entrust them to some manager. Maybe you'd have to keep going every decade or so and say, I'm still alive, keep managing it. You know, it's not quite like Futurama where he just puts his money in a bank and then shows up in 1,000 years later and he's earned all this interest.
That's so true. You know, I don't know that even if I could go back, you know, to go back 100 years, I don't know what things I could invest in that would be guaranteed, because even with hindsight, because so many things come and go in that time frame. Many of the companies
right.
that would have become successful ended up going bust as well too. So, I mean, what could you really have bought? All of these things are ephemeral. And even when you talk about the Dow, you can't buy the Dow. You're buying some components in the Dow. And the Dow changes over time. And the stock
right.
that it's composed of changes. And so, you know, you could have bought the hottest whale oil company there was back in the 1800s. And then that company ends up becoming nothing. And you go on to buy, you know, some electric utility that goes bust in the 30s, and
right.
it's an almost impossible task. I mean, heck, you know what? I was going through an exercise myself. I was thinking, if I could go back a year, would I know exactly what to invest in to totally succeed? And you know what? I don't think in my own mind that I have a good enough understanding of the days when there were rallies and declines that I could really play the market. Even if I went back, rewound a year, I'm not sure I could come out being rich.
Well, yeah, it's hard to remember.
I don't have
every
an
detail, but
sorry?
You could buy gold at the bottom in March 2009. That would have been pretty great. I don't think there would have been a single market that went up as much as that. But
yeah,
I could be wrong. I'm sure there were some older, oversold stocks that went up more than that. But
there's some things I could have done in general. But, you know, if you actually had a record of everything that had happened, an actual daily Dow kind of a thing, well, then you could really play. But if you're just kind of remembering in general what some stocks did and what some markets did, unless you have that timing down to the month and the day,
right.
It's really hard.
I got it for you. October 19th, 1987. All you got to do is time travel to the few days before, a week before, and put all your money into, like, put options or something. There
yeah.
you go. That's how you could invest with time travel.
Well, I think we've exhausted the possibilities of rational economic discussion for the which I suppose is fitting for a holiday week for the holidays coming up now. And I thank you again, Elliot, for calling in.
All righty, thanks, Michael.
And to all our listeners, thanks for tuning in again to another weekly episode of the Weekly Economics and Financial Roundup with the Optimistic Bear and guest hosts. And we'll be back next Tuesday at the same time, 9 p.m. Pacific time, as we always are. We haven't missed an episode in over a year. Well, we've only been on the air for a little over a year, so we've never missed an episode. So until next time, everyone, enjoy your week in the markets.